From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Iowa's community colleges are in a state of flux. They're seeing explosive growth in enrollment. But how should the colleges cope with more students at a time of budget cuts? In the next half hour, I talk with Steve Oval of the Iowa Association of Community College Presidents. Then in the second half hour, we meet Iowa teacher Sarah Brown Wessling of Johnston High School. Wessling was named the 2010 Iowa Teacher of the Year by the Iowa Department of Education. And now she's one of four finalists for the National Teacher of the Year Award. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, education in the state is our focus. A little later in the hour, what does it take to be a great teacher? Well, we meet Iowa teacher Sarah Brown Wessling of Johnston High School. Wessling was named the 2010 Iowa Teacher of the Year by the Iowa Department of Education. She's one of four finalists for the National Teacher of the Year Award. That conversation, Sarah joining us live in the second half of our program. But first, nationally, enrollment in two-year schools is at an all-time high of nearly 12 million. That's 44% of the total for all U.S. campuses. Here in Iowa, the enrollment numbers in our state's community colleges continue to spike, and Iowa's 15 institutions are struggling to deal with budget cuts and one-time federal stimulus funds at a time when more displaced workers are seeking new employment skills. Joining me now to discuss community colleges in our state in a state of flux is Steve Oval of the Iowa Association of Community College Presidents and Trustees. Steve is also Kirkwood Community College's Executive Director of Governmental Relations. He joins us from Des Moines by phone. Good afternoon, Steve.
Hi, Ben. Glad to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Let's talk about this annual condition of Iowa's community colleges, the 2009 report released on January 14th by the Iowa Department of Education. Give us some details on this spike in enrollment at Iowa's community colleges. How much of an increase? When did it start?
Well, this current fiscal year, there was a very dramatic increase. Overall, across the state, that increase was 14.3%. And in fact, our enrollment went over 100,000 credit students for the first time ever, which is just really an incredible threshold when you think about that. And that's the fall headcount, that kind of 10th day report that we use as kind of a benchmark from year to year. There were colleges, my institution had an increase of 17%, and there were a number of colleges that had increases in excess of 20%. Some of their campuses, I know the DMAC Urban Campus, had an increase of well over 30%, which is just an incredible change in their enrollment in those particular institutions.
Mm-hmm. Historically, have these institutions ever seen such dramatic rises in enrollment? That you know?
Yeah, we have. I mean, during the first part of this decade, we had a five-year period in which there was very, very steady, consistent growth. In fact, really over the last 40 years, there have only been, I think, 4 years where there wasn't an increase from, 1 year to the next. So it's been a very, very steady growth pattern. But the increase this year was particularly dramatic. And I think there are a number of conditions that are driving that. I think more and more direct from high school graduates are understanding that in order to secure a well-paying job, they do need some kind of post-secondary training and education. So I think the number of high school graduates coming to our institutions continues to increase. But clearly, the impact of the economy and a significant number of Iowans who are being laid off and losing their jobs has had an impact as well. I know in my institution, the percentage of students over the age of 25 this year increased by 33% just this year alone, which is an indication that we have a lot of returning adults coming to our institutions during this time of economic downturn.
So whereas in a generation or two ago, a high school diploma would have been fine for a lot of the jobs, the technical skills that are being given by our community colleges, the students have to go on now.
That's very true. And in fact, recent studies conducted at the national level are focusing on kind of what they're calling these kind of middle-skill jobs. Those are required more than a high school diploma but less than a four-year baccalaureate degree. And many of those are in technical skilled disciplines. And in fact, we still have employers telling us that they're still having a hard time finding skilled workers in those middle-skill jobs, even despite the state of the economy right now.
So in what specific programs are you seeing the most increase?
Well, the largest enrollment in our community colleges in terms of our current technical ed programs, the largest cohort of students are in our allied health programs and nursing in particular. There continues to be a continued growing demand for graduates in those programs. The second largest is in the business and information technology cluster. And third would be advanced manufacturing. And again, we continue to see strong demand in all three of those sectors.
Mm-hmm. What are your concerns as this growth continues?
Well, the real challenge is the budget cuts that we continue to sustain at this point. The 10% across the board cut that we had to absorb during this this fiscal year. I know in my institution alone, that was a cost of about $2.4 million that we're in the process now of basically peeling out of our budget, and it's a broad range of things that we're focused on doing that. I think the thing that's difficult as we go into the fiscal year 2011 budgeting year is the fact that from fiscal year 09 into the current fiscal year, our base state general aid appropriation was actually reduced by 12%. That's prior to the 10% across the board cut. But very fortunately, the legislature used some of the federal stimulus money to backfill that 12% cut to get us kind of back up to that fiscal year 09 level. The problem with that is, as we go into budgeting for the fiscal year 2011 period, we now have a state general aid base that's 12% below where it was a year ago. Put another 10% cut on top of that, and the legislature is looking at the need to carve another $500+ million, which would be, potentially another 10% cut in our budget. We're theoretically looking at a budget situation going into 2011 in which we could find ourselves 30% below where we were 2 years ago, and at a time when we have record enrollments. That kind of funding level, Ben, would take us back to where we were in about 1997 when we had about 65,000 to 70,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have 100,000 students.
Sounds dramatic. So where have you found the savings thus far, and where are you going to find the savings for these projected shortfalls?
Well, this has not been an easy process. I know in the case of my institution, we've engaged the entire institution in making recommendations and helping us do that. We're kind of cutting across the board in terms of our operational expenses. We're working very, very hard on achieving energy efficiencies within the college. That's something we've been working on for quite some time, and it's really providing some important benefits during this time of budget cutting. But it's true with any institution of education, 75% of our budget is still in staff and faculty wages and benefits. And so it's a case of incentivizing our early retirement program. We have, in my institution, we've not yet had to resort to furloughs or involuntary layoffs. I know there are other community colleges which have implemented some furloughs. But clearly, we're looking at every opportunity to achieve as many efficiencies as we can. The challenge with all of that is the fact that we continue to have to staff class sections to accommodate the growing number of students that we have. A lot of that is done with adjunct faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think there's no really one single thing that any of us are using to try to address it. It's a lot of smaller things coupled together getting us to that point.
What role will tuition hikes play in meeting those shortfalls?
Well, that's none of our boards of trustees like to look at any kind of tuition increases in excess of inflation, but we're just not going to have an opportunity, I think, to hold our tuition at that level. So we're going to see tuition increases that none of us are going to be comfortable with, I'm afraid to say. What's happened is that the percentage of our budgets that are supported by state general aid has continued to decline. I think statewide it's around 39%. In my institution, is down to 32%. So So tuition is now supporting in excess of 50% of our budgets, and so that's really the only discretionary area that we have to help us in terms of addressing some of these state general aid budget shortfalls.
Mm-hmm. Steve, you said that none of you are going to be comfortable on the Board of Trustees with the tuition increases. Can you put any numbers that have been bounced around, talked about, as far as future tuition hikes at the community colleges?
But I could just look at my own institution as an example. I think for a number of years, we've and our tuition right now is $111 a credit hour, and we've been experiencing $4 a year credit hour increases. So we've been in that kind of 3.9 to 4.5% range. As we're modeling the anticipated budget reductions that we're looking at right now, it's very possible that we're looking at an $8 or $9 increase, which would be you know, approximately a 7.5 to 8% increase.
Mm-hmm. So over the course of a 2-year education at a community college, do you have a figure on what that would add to it?
Well, I think the average tuition right now is about $3,500 on average. Ours would be just slightly less than that. So, you know, you figure an 8% increase on that, that would give you your answer.
Mm-hmm. And also, some of these technical classes, the ones that are in most demand, I understand, are some of the most expensive to teach.
No question about that. Not only to teach, but to equip. And we also have limitations just in terms of the number of students that we can put into many of these technical classes. Many times a section is limited to maybe 18 to 24 students in terms of a faculty to student ratio, and given the capacity in our labs. So we have a lot of those programs right now that are either full or in some cases have waiting lists for students to get into them, which is also not a desirable situation.
So the limits are imposed because the students have to be paired up with equipment, for instance.
Correct. That's mm-hmm. correct. Yeah. Okay. With very few exceptions, most of those programs have a very strong hands-on component to it. And again, there's just a limit to the amount of equipment that you can have in a particular lab, whether it's computer-based or equipment-based.
Okay, we're talking about Iowa's community colleges in a state of flux, dramatically increasing enrollment at the community colleges. That, with the backdrop of the bad economy, also the cut in funding for the community colleges, as many state institutions are suffering these cuts as well. Steve Oval of the Iowa Association of Community College Presidents and Trustees is with us. Coming up, Steve will stay with us after we take a short break. He'll be back along with Roger Utman, Iowa Department of Education's Community College Division Administrator, will join our conversation when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Education is our focus in the state this hour on The Exchange. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk to Iowa teacher Sarah Brown Wessling of Johnston High School, named the 2010 Iowa Teacher of the Year by the Iowa Department of Education. She's one of four finalists in the nation for the National Teacher of the Year Award. So we'll find out what goes into making a great teacher when we talk to Sarah in just a few minutes. Right now, talking about Iowa's community colleges in a state of flux, dramatically increasing enrollment at the same time as budget cuts. Not a good combination. Steve Oval with us of the Iowa Association of Community College Presidents and Trustees. He's also Kirkwood Community College's Executive Director of Governmental Relations. Joining us now, in addition to Steve, Roger Utman, Iowa Department of Education Community College Division Administrator. Welcome to you, Roger.
Yes, thank you.
Had a little trouble getting you on. We wanted to have you on since the beginning of the program. I think you've been listening to the conversation that Steve and I have been having here. What do you have to add to this in terms of how these shortfalls, projected shortfalls, will be accommodated in the face of growing enrollment?
I assume you're talking about shortfalls
in budget, the budget shortfalls, the revenues going to the community colleges.
Well, I know that the colleges, as well as the Board of Trustees, always had a commitment to try and keep tuition at the lowest possible rate, but that is one of the few things that the colleges had to look at when they're looking at budget shortfalls.
Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on how tuition will rise at the 15 institutions in the coming year or two?
Well, there won't be any official rate increases for tuition set until the colleges all have an idea of where the funding from the state will be coming from this year. But we're already hearing that there will be at least, in some cases, an $8 per credit hour increase up to a $12 credit hour increase.
Mm-hmm. What I'm sure you've discussed the quality of education that is being given at the Iowa's community colleges too. How can that be maintained in the face of these pressures, to open new sections, new classes? Do you, for instance, have the number of quality instructors that you would like?
Well, that's always an issue for each of the colleges, whether it's one of the small institutions or one of the larger ones, is trying to be able to have qualified faculty, as it is spelled out in Iowa code what kind of qualifications each of the instructors has to have. So while each of the colleges makes the commitment to try and create sections if they need to, that is an issue for them.
Mm-hmm. Steve, can you talk about that specifically at Kirkwood Community College, how you maintain the quality of education when opening new sections, trying to find instructors who can teach with the quality that you're used to at the institution?
Well, it's always a challenge in our current technical ed programs because we often are hiring individuals that are coming to us from the business community, and many times we're having to compete with salaries in the private sector that are really far in excess of what we're able to pay our full-time faculty, and so that in and of itself is always a challenge. Fortunately, we've been very, very fortunate to find very, very high-quality faculty and individuals that also have a real passion for teaching, many of whom, many cases, may have gone through some of our programs years ago, mm-hmm. been out in the private sector very successfully, and now have a real passion for coming back. Adjunct instructors, I think this year, our chief academic officer and our deans tried to get out ahead of that curve a little bit, knowing that we were probably going to be experiencing a fairly dramatic spike in enrollment, and so we identified a pool of very highly qualified adjunct instructors that we could call on if, in fact, that growth did occur, which, in fact, was the case. But, boy, when you're having to scramble, you know, a couple of weeks before classes start to identify adjunct instructors to teach new class sections, it's very, very demanding. I think those of us that are in larger urban areas probably have a little bit easier time doing that than our colleagues do in the rural areas. I know in our case, many times we're able to pull spouses with master's degrees or PhDs, they're maybe following their husband to a faculty position at the University of Iowa, as an example. Mm-hmm. So we're able to, you know, pull that kind of expertise. But it's very difficult for many of our rural community colleges.
Jan in Marion has an email question to follow up on this aspect. Could your guests comment on the class size issue? I know one-on-one between students and teachers has always made Kirkwood a desirable choice. Are class sizes growing? That changes the teacher-student dynamic?
Very moderately. And again, in our current technical ed classes, they really all have kind of a fixed limit in terms of the number of students that that we can accommodate. And when we reach that, then we're done. The mm-hmm. students really have to go on a wait list, or we try to advise them to look at some other career opportunities where we might have some availability. But in the arts and science classes, we may have seen a slight increase in our class loads, but we're very, very attentive to trying to keep those to a very logical, manageable size. And that, I think in most cases, would be, you know, not exceeding 35 students in a class.
When we look at that the latest annual report on the condition of Iowa's community colleges, what does it say about what students are doing after they get out of the community college in Iowa? What are they doing with those two-year degrees?
Well, in a lot of cases, the students are going right to work, and they're ending up with some very good jobs out there. Of course, with the job market the way it is, it makes it a little more difficult this year, but they still are doing very well in the job market.
Are they staying here in Iowa for those jobs?
Yes. The state has a tradition of staying in the state, the students staying in the state. basically 78% of those students who graduate with an award from the colleges stay in the state.
Mm-hmm. I remember not too long ago we did a show on wind power in Iowa where technical colleges were in a lot of demand because of the boom in wind power in the state. So these types of things, newly emerging technologies.
And that, again, is one of the things that the colleges have been very good about, is working with their regions of the state to see what kind of demands there is from industry for programs.
How does Iowa's community colleges, how do they compare with the two-year colleges in other states? Are they experiencing exactly the same kind of problems? Are we better or worse off than other states?
I think probably in some cases we're better off. Like, for example, in California, we have heard that there are enrollment limitations there, or if students are trying to enroll in courses, some of the courses that they need to take or want to take are not available.
Mm-hmm. And I see that Iowa's graduation rate consistently outperforms the national average in community colleges as well. Well, how do you account for that?
Just a good education. But I think one of the things that we leave out of that number sometimes is we have the colleges have students that complete all the graduation requirements but don't officially ask to have the degree awarded. So those students are not included in those numbers. So really, while the state of Iowa does better nationally, the students that don't officially complete the paperwork for the award, those students are not included in the percentages.
Mm-hmm. I'd like each of you we have just a couple minutes left to look maybe even 5 or 10 years into the future past perhaps this bad economy. Perhaps the economy will recover in the next year or two. What trends do you see in the next 5 or 10 years that community colleges will be affected by? Can I ask you to go first, Roger?
Probably, again, trying to stay up with the different industries, the need for different industries. One of the things that the state is getting into is more the green jobs area. So seeing what types of things may come out of that. Also with the STEM initiatives, STEM being science, technology, engineering, and math, the requirements in those programs and what some of those programs may be here in the next 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Steve Oval, what do you have to add to that as we look into the future 5 or 10 years?
Well, I think a pattern that we're seeing right now is a movement towards articulating many of our short-term non-credit skill certificate programs with our credit degree programs and diploma programs. There's a very strong focus on developing articulated or laddered career pathways so that individuals that come to us with maybe no post-secondary training or education, very low adult basic ed skills, we can get them onto a skill-building pathway that will move them progressively over time into better paying and higher skilled jobs. I know all of us are working on that right now, and I think that's going to be a very, very important step forward, because in states like Iowa that have really very flat population growth, the workforce that's going to drive our state's economy in the years ahead is already in the Iowa workforce. Many of them are low-skilled, low-income working adults, and we've got to find better ways of getting them engaged in acquiring post-secondary training and education.
Thank you very much, Steve Oval, Roger Uttman, for joining us for this half hour. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up, what does it take to be a great teacher? We meet Iowa teacher Sarah Brown-Wessling. She's one of 4 finalists for the National Teacher of the Year Award. That when we return in a few minutes. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us over the noon hour. What does it take to be a great teacher? Well, that's the central question for the remainder of the hour. My next guest is Iowa teacher Sarah Brown-Wessling. Wessling is a finalist for the National Teacher of the Year Award. She's among 4 finalists for the award. The other finalists are from California, Florida, and Michigan. Last fall, Wessling was named the 2010 Iowa Teacher of the Year by the Iowa Department of Education. It was a former student of hers, Tyler Buller, who nominated Wessling for the Iowa Teaching Award. In his nomination letter, Tyler wrote, "I find myself craving the same lifelong learning that drives Sarah to connect with students and constantly seek to improve her own knowledge and education." Wessling has taught at Johnston High School for 10 years, where she is chairperson of the English department. Wessling also taught in the Cedar Falls Community School District for a year. Sarah Brown Wessling joins us by phone from her home in Johnston, where she is currently on maternity leave. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, and congratulations, I guess, on two counts.
Oh, thank you very much.
I hope the little one is in a good place so that we can have a few minutes of conversation.
Yeah, he is.
Very good. When did you first know you wanted to be a teacher, Sarah?
Well, that's a good question. You know, actually, I don't know if I knew that I was going to be a teacher or if it was just kind of a realization of something that I probably always knew. I come from a family of teachers. My maternal grandmother is one of 11 children. Every single one of them graduated from college, even the seven females. And she's almost 90 now, and she's the youngest of all of those. And in every generation, there is a teacher in that family. And so I think teaching is kind of what we do. It took me a little while to figure out when I was in college what I really wanted to do. I started out actually as a broadcast journalism major, and then changed my major several times, like many students do. Mm-hmm. I spent some time in the philosophy department, the psychology department, and throughout all of that, I always still had this yearning, to learn and to share that passion with other people. And finally, I just realized that one way for me to pursue all of those interests was to do it in the classroom.
Was there a particular teacher who comes to mind who inspired you when you were growing up in high school or junior high or elementary?
You know, I was really fortunate to, actually I'm really fortunate to be truly a product of the Iowa school system. I wasn't born in Winterset, but I was raised in Winterset and went to school there. And then I got both my undergraduate and graduate degrees at Iowa State. And then I've taught in Cedar Falls and Johnston, where I've been mentored by incredible teachers here in the state. And so I think that I've been blessed to just constantly, in each of those different stages of my life, be around teachers who have inspired me. My mom is a teacher, and so, of course, she holds a very special place as one of those formative teachers. I had a fourth grade teacher who inspired a love of writing for me, and I had several college professors who were just instrumental in helping me to really pursue my passion.
Mm-hmm. So you teach at the high school level now. What is the key to connecting with teenagers in the classroom?
I think probably the key to connecting with teenagers is to be an intuitive teacher. I think that one of my great responsibilities is to, first of all, respect every student for who they are when they walk in that door and not have expectations that, you know, by the time they walk in this door, every student should have this set of experiences or this set of knowledge, but just to appreciate them for exactly who they are at that moment. And when I can do that, I can start to figure out the story of their learning. And when I hear and can understand the story of their learning, I think that that's what connects to them, mm-hmm. that it's truly my desire to help them become the best version of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular rituals or habits or perhaps a turn of phrase that you are known for in the classroom when someone would say, oh, Sarah always does this. I really love this about Sarah. What would you say?
I think that probably my students would say that I oftentimes ask them to trust me, because one of the things that I notice in teaching high school students is that a lot of times they are very nervous to make mistakes. And if they're going to learn, they're going to have to make some mistakes, or at least they're going to have to be presented with the kinds of challenges that allow them to, you know, push their own limits. And they're nervous about that. And so I'm constantly having to tell them, you have to trust me. It's going to be okay. That's probably one thing. And I'm a self-proclaimed geek in a lot of ways, and I'm unashamed of that.
Geek in a technology way.
Sometimes in a technology way, although, I do have friends who could put me to shame in the technology department. But I am a little bit of a technology geek, and just because I love words and language so much that, you know, a student will say a word in a way that maybe I haven't heard it in a long time, and I just get really excited. Or maybe, you know, a student will ask a question about a word, and so we have to go look it up. And I'm just excited about their ideas and who they are. And I think that enthusiasm sometimes just gives us all a good chuckle.
Mm-hmm. When you think back to your time in high school, what do you see as the biggest changes between the classroom you experienced as a student and the one you are in now as a teacher?
I think the changes are tremendous. I am very, very proud to be a graduate of Winterset High School and of the Winterset school system. But I also think that certainly in those, you know, last 15 or so years, there have been some huge changes. And certainly one of those, I think, is the degree of rigor that we expect our students to have. I think that we certainly expect our students to be 21st century learners now, which means that the disciplines for our learners have to collapse, that we cannot compartmentalize math and English and science and all of those different disciplines, that we have to challenge and help our students to see how these collapse so that they can be strong contributing members to this global and very changing society.
Mm-hmm.
I also think there's a lot of pressure on teachers, on school systems, on students that wasn't there when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm. Are the challenges, the pressures on students, on teachers these days greater than in previous times?
I do think so. I think that ever since, you know, the No Child Left Behind legislation took effect, that there has been a different tenor in public education across the country. And in some ways, that legislation has really helped us to take a very close look at some, you know, specific student groups. And in that way, I appreciate it. But in other ways, it has created certainly a sense of, for some teachers, I think it's a little bit of being scared, being nervous that they're not doing their job well enough when they are working tirelessly. So, yes, it definitely is a different environment.
Mm-hmm. I've been, I think it was last week's Newsweek had an article on this, and to see if you could comment on, we've talked about technology, and that's certainly a big difference between students now and students a generation or two ago, dealing with a lot of technology, social media, Twitter, and so forth. A lot of talk about if the technology has changed our relationship to reading. Are we now confined to 140 characters and what we can absorb?
Yeah. That's a great question. I think that I do think that technology is to some degree changing the kinds of skills that our students come to us with. And I think as teachers, we have an opportunity to really look at this from two perspectives. I think certainly from one perspective, we have to kind of guard against just letting students only be able to function in that social media arena, because that limits them and it limits their ability to see, you know, the potential of technology and to really see the role of literacy in their lives. However, on the other hand, I think that we can embrace what our students are bringing to us. And I think that we have to allow ourselves as teachers to capitalize on the skills that our students are inherently bringing to us. And our challenge becomes, I don't think, suppressing some of those skills that they have, but really helping them to understand how do you capitalize on your ability to write something, you know, in this, you know, brief Twitter, you know, post, and how can you use that sense of brevity then to write a grant when you need to. And so I think that it's about helping our students, again, capitalize on those skills and then really apply them to very real-world situations.
I was looking at your website and your philosophy of teaching captured in 10 points that you've laid out there. I'd like to ask you about a few of them. This one, actually number 10 at the end, students should experience all strands of literacy and recognize their individual and collective influence on each person. Explain what you mean by that.
I think a lot of times, kind of like I mentioned earlier, sometimes we decide, or because of the nature of public schools, we compartmentalize disciplines. And I think that a lot of times in English education or in literacy, we compartmentalize as well. And instead, what I think we need to do is we need to help students see how reading and writing and speaking and viewing and listening all, you know, function together. And when those different strands of literacy function together, I think we create the kind of student, again, who can contribute to a very fast-paced, very literate society. You know, we kind of talked about that social media. Students have to write, they have to read all day long. And again, part of what our job is as teachers, part of our challenge, is to help them, you know, take those skills and use them in very productive ways.
Do you have a question for Iowa's 2010 Teacher of the Year? Sarah Brown Wessling is with us for the remainder of the hour of Johnston High School, named the 2010 Iowa Teacher of the Year by the Iowa Department of Education, one of four finalists for the National Teacher of the Year Award. If you do, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We all know the nation's diversity and Iowa's diversity is growing, Sarah. So how is that reflected in what you study in your English class?
I think that one of the things that we do in our classes is we have to be sure to create experiences for students to what I like to call windows and mirrors. And when I present students with texts, sometimes I want to present them with texts that are mirrors of themselves, because we know that students really can connect with the reading process and with characters when they see bits of themselves reflected in what they're reading. But on the other hand, I also like to talk to my students about having windows into other cultures. And so I think it's imperative. And certainly in the district that I teach in, where we don't have as much diversity as other school districts have, I think it's absolutely imperative that we offer students the opportunity to see into other cultures. And I feel so fortunate to teach in a discipline like English, where I can readily connect students to cultures through poetry, through novels, and we certainly, our whole department is very vigilant about offering diverse authors and time periods and cultures in the form of literature.
Okay, let's go to our first caller. Jason is joining us from Waterloo. Hi, Jason. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hello. Thanks. I guess you kind of answered part of one of my questions. I have two questions for you, ask real quick. The first one is, knowing that you come from a small town in Iowa and Iowa's population, how much leeway or give or take do you have, knowing Iowa's educational system, into promoting or discussing or teaching non-white or non-Western English literature? And then the other question would be, how difficult is it for you if coming from a small town in Iowa, teaching students that don't come from your same background or same culture? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks, Jason from Waterloo. Again, hanging on there, the diversity question there.
Sure.
Sarah.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thinking about the second question, I think that in some ways, it's not that difficult to teach students who don't come from the same background when I am a teacher who is willing to learn and to understand and is fascinated by other cultures and wants to see, you know, see the opportunities where they present themselves to make sure that all of my students have a broad perspective. And so I guess in that sense, my windows have been oftentimes texts and you know, conversations that I've had with people or travels that I've had that have put me in contact with folks from other cultures. And it's that same sense of tolerance and empathy that certainly we need to have in our classrooms, and that I think any teacher can find a way to bring into his or her classroom.
Mm-hmm. An anonymous email for you, Sarah, this comment. Mm-hmm. I am troubled that the focus of administrators continues to be solely on teachers when it comes to improving overall school or student performance. I know from experience that a child will struggle to succeed in school unless he or she has an involved family or strong support system. Students need to know that they will be held accountable at school and at home. The best principals, the best teachers, and the best lesson plans may all be for naught if a child's family is not involved in his or her education. Could Ms. Wessling comment?
Certainly. Well, one of the reasons I think that administrators probably spend a lot of time talking or focusing on the role of teachers in the classroom is because there is a lot of research that tells us the single most important factor to a student's improvement from one year to the next is the teacher that that student has, and the degree to which that teacher can help that student move from wherever he or she is at to that next step. And so I would think that that certainly would be part of it. However, I think that the person who wrote the email has touched on something extraordinarily important, which is the role of family. And certainly in education, we recognize the importance of teaching the whole child, that certainly cannot just be academic, and that we want to be sure, kind of like I mentioned earlier, to introduce students to tolerance in all kinds of situations and empathy. And I have a son who's in kindergarten, and he's doing the pillars of character. Mm-hmm. And so certainly those are important. I think that working with parents at home is very, very key. But I also know from some of my experiences working with students that sometimes that at-home connection is just not as fluid as the student or the school would like it to be. And so the best that I can do, the best that we can do in the school, is to take that student for who he or she is and help them flourish as much as we can.
I want to go back to your list. This is found on your website, your philosophy of teaching captured mm-hmm. in 10 points. One of the points states, classrooms should be learner-centered in nature, with the teacher as the lead learner. Now, it's interesting to think about it that way, the teacher as the lead learner. In former times, I think the philosophy, wasn't it, I teach, you learn, students?
Absolutely. I certainly consider myself to be the lead learner in the classroom. If you walked into my classroom, one of the first things that you would notice is that my desk is in the back corner, the furthest corner of the classroom, because the classroom is our environment. It's our place to learn. And although I am in there and I am learning with them, I think that there's a great deal of power in modeling the kind of passion that we need to see and we want to see our own students bring to their educational experience. And so I am just as passionate about, this new interpretation of a text that I've read 10 times, or mm-hmm. I am just as passionate about, what a student has decided they want to talk about today. And
do you have a specific example of something you learned from your student, from your classroom experience, that you couldn't have learned anywhere else in your teaching experience?
I think my students teach me things all of the time, and I think probably one of the things that they teach me the most is the importance of listening. And when I really listen to students and really listen to what it is that they're saying or what their struggle is, I think that more than anything else helps me to help them take that next step in their learning process.
You are chairperson of the English department at Johnston High School and teach literature. Now, in your philosophy, literature, you say, is best taught and learned when readers can connect with it. What classics do you find connect with 21st century high school students these days?
I've had experience teaching a lot of different classics to students, and I have found that in the end, nearly any classic can relate to students today when the teacher has taken the time to understand where the students are coming from and how those, universal and timeless themes connect to, our world today. I have really enjoyed teaching To Kill a Mockingbird. I have recently really enjoyed teaching Death of a Salesman, just because I think that a lot of the concepts in there are very relevant to our students today, to our families today, as we kind of contend with uncertain economic times.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach Death of a Salesman in a unit on the American Dream, and along with that is The Great Gatsby. And like I said, because of the role of our economy in our students' everyday lives, the notion of the American Dream is taking a different perspective for them. And so certainly that seems to resonate.
Sarah, we have just about a minute left. You are one of four finalists for the National Teacher of the Year Award. Where does it go from here? What happens now? When will a winner be announced?
Well, there is an interview process that takes place during the first week of March. It's a two-day interview process where I, along with the other three finalists, will convene in Washington, D.C. and do a variety of different experiences. And then the National Teacher of the Year is announced in April by President Obama.
Very good. And you will be traveling to Washington. We're assuming that you're going to win this.
Well, we'll see.
We'll all be cheering for you, Sarah. And, you know, you've made all Iowans very proud of our great education tradition here in Iowa. Thank you very much for this conversation, and congratulations again on being selected for this award.
Well, thank you very much. I am very proud to be a representative of this great state. So thank you.
Very good. Iowa teacher Sarah Brown-Wessling of Johnston High School, named the 2010 Iowa Teacher of the Year by the Iowa Department of Education, one of just four finalists for the National Teacher of the Year Award. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins, our producer assistant today, Christoph Mai, technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.